Thank you for inviting me to give a talk, and thank Gary for being my agent today, try to give me a job. So it's always a fun meeting, and I think I'm lucking out because I also have a Terry-motivated graph to start off my talk. It's a little different, though. Well, we just heard about looking at these ranges here from, you know, millisecond or so to about days. I'm going to be at different time scales. So as this graph shows, and kind of what was just being discussed, is that there are a lot of dynamics, you know, at different temporal levels in the brain. And neuroscientists typically focus on, you know, things that are operating relatively fast, you know, relative to, you know, where we live our lives in the days and weeks and months. And the same goes for plasticity mechanisms. We have things like spike timing plasticity, which we heard about this morning, and, you know, various, you know, structural plasticity levels that can happen at seconds or minutes. But generally, the forms of plasticity and neural dynamics tend to operate on relatively short timescales. So my talk today is going to really begin to ask the question, what about these long timescales here?
Your graph upside down.
No, it's rotated by 90 degrees.
I have no space in my graph, so... So why do long timescales matter? Well, I think from a perceptual point of view and in motor behaviors, generally shorter timescales are fine in many cases. We just heard a case of visual system where you can go into really long timescales with, you know, some top-down control. But from a memory point of view, you know, memory on the order of milliseconds and seconds is, or hundreds of milliseconds is nice, but, you know, most of the memories that we're really interested in as neuroscientists tend to be really long timescales. And so my talk today is going to focus on a form of plasticity, which is relatively new to the field, I mean, the last 20 years or so, and that is adult neurogenesis. And I'm going to argue that it kind of fills in some of these longer gaps. So for those of you who aren't as familiar, and we've brought this up at the TDLC meetings in the last few years, so it's probably becoming an old story, I guess, but adult neurogenesis is the process by which new neurons actually are incorporated into the adult brain. And it's only occurring in two areas, the dentate gyrus and the hippocampus and the olfactory bulb. So my work in Rusty Gage's lab tends to focus on, we mostly focus on dentate gyrus neurogenesis, which is well positioned for having a profound impact on memory, which is thus well suited for these longer timescales. So the neurogenesis process really is a very slow dynamic, relatively speaking. Neurons are born from a progenitor stem cell population, and over a course of a couple of weeks to a few months, they gradually grow and develop similarly to most neurons in the rest of the brain during development. There are very distinct physiology properties throughout this process. Some of the key ones that will be important for this talk are GABA, which is normally inhibitory, we generally think of it as having a suppressive effect on neuronal activity, is actually depolarizing for these first few weeks of their development. And this is also similar to embryonic development in many cases. And the other facet that's very important is that at these longer times, such as 3 to 6 weeks, the young neurons tend to have increased plasticity. And I just always throw this in there that not all these cells survive. That's why the brain isn't just, you know, constantly doubling in size every few months. The rate tends to be relatively low. We're talking maybe 3 to 5% of the neurons in the dentate are new in the rat. And since they only live for a few years, it's, you know, not a huge effect long term. But in humans, over many years, obviously the way of measuring it is more difficult, but we believe it is still a robust number of new cells coming in. So my approach has been in collaboration with Janet Wiles, who's in the University of Queensland, and Rusty Gage, has been to use computational modeling to begin to ask what these new cells are doing in the computations of the hippocampus. So the model I use is a multi-layer neural network model of the dentate gyrus. So I'm focusing specifically on the region where the new neurons are incorporating in, The local feedback interneuron populations, of which most are inhibitory, but there are some excitatory feedbacks, as well as the intraoral cortex cortical inputs to the dentate. And I'm not going to go into all the details of the model, and you know, we published this last year, and I'm happy to talk to anyone later about the specific details. But the general idea is that I grow the network from scratch. That is, all the dentate granule cells, the main cells of the dentate gyrus, are born into the network and move through this maturation process on their own. So all the granule cells have been new neurons at one point or another. And at a certain point in the network, when it gets to a certain size, I stop neurogenesis in test groups or continue neurogenesis in the experimental groups, and then later on test for certain behaviors and the neuronal dynamics. So back to our little temporal scales. The first thing I wanted to look at was how new neurons are affecting pattern separation. So for those of you familiar with the hippocampus, pattern separation is actually a process which has long been ascribed to the dentate gyrus. Now, if you're talking to an in vivo physiologist or a behavioralist or a computational modeler, pattern separation might mean slightly different things. So from my perspective, I'm basically looking at the population code of neurons in the dentate gyrus and saying that how the dentate layer decorrelates these inputs, the inputs. So the idea basically is that two intraoral cortex inputs might have a certain amount of correlation, and they'll activate distinct populations, sparse populations of dentate gyrus neurons, and those populations will be completely different. And as a result, the downstream activity in the rest of the hippocampus will be distinct. So memories that are formed through these relatively overlapping inputs can be well separated. This graph would be familiar to at least one person in the audience. The idea in my analysis generally is to vary the input. So, you know, manually control intraoral cortex and just measure the normalized dot product, or essentially a correlation of the outputs of the granule cell layer. So when I do this in the model, I don't get the very nice idealized result of O'Reilly and McClellan from 15 years ago, but I do get a strong pattern separation effect. So if you look at the blue line on the bottom, the networks that do not have neurogenesis or have had neurogenesis cease after, for a while, are very potent pattern separators. This is just as theoretically predicted and has been kind of assumed by people in the hippocampus field for a long time. The interesting thing happens when you add neurogenesis. We actually expected the pattern separation would be much stronger. But in fact, with this measure at least, pattern separation gets worse by having immature neurons in the network. So like I said, in the no neurogenesis group, everything was born with neurogenesis. It just none of the cells are immature at this point. But in the red network, you have a heterogeneous population of granule cells. So when you dig into it a little bit, it's not hard to you quickly find that what's happening is that you get correlations based on immature neurons responding to multiple events. So while the immature cells are very potent separators and continue to be strong separators in the presence of new neurons, the immature cells are kind of disrupting the separation. So this was kind of a disconcerting result. We actually were like, why is neurogenesis making it worse to do what it does? But the next thing we kind of looked at was, well, you know, these cells are not statically immature. The maturation implies a change. And so what I did was I actually measured this pattern separation effect over time. And as these new cells, so I took the same paradigm that I just showed and then let them network mature a little bit, tested pattern separation again, but with the same set of inputs, and then kind of measured correlation between events, the separations, from time, like one day, and then wait a few days later, test the model again, and then compare the outputs from those different days. And you actually see that the network improves in its pattern separation the more time between the events. So while the immature neurons seem to disrupt pattern separation considerably for events that are immediately at the same time, you actually get stronger pattern separation in some cases for events that are distinct in time. And it's, again, you dig into it a little bit, and it's not hard to see that what actually is happening is that these immature neurons, they mature, you know, that were messing up pattern separation early on, tend to actually, you know, they'll mature and they'll quiet down and they become pattern separators just like every other neuron in the granule cell layer. And now you have a new set of immature neurons that are themselves, you know, pattern integrating, what we're calling it at this time, but it allows strong temporal separation across these times. So I guess I threw this slide in here because when I've talked about this before, people think, okay, well, the neurogenesis disrupts pattern separation. You know, you're not getting, so either don't have pattern separation with neurogenesis or you don't have pattern separation without neurogenesis. In fact, what we think is happening is that if you have no neurogenesis, you don't get very good pattern separation. The network just tends to kind of, will end up associating events that are comparable in some form. But without neurogenesis, the dentate's a very strong pattern separator. It does a very good job of this. It's kind of hard to show in two dimensions pattern separation in a million-dimensional space, but it does pretty well. But when you have neurogenesis, what we think is happening is that you actually get a pattern separation still, but it's structured temporally. And it allows memories to be formed with some sort of temporal context encoded. So while things are separated, they're a little more organized, at least, from a temporal dimension. So the next level that we looked at was actually this very long time scale, getting into weeks and months. And so this is kind of venturing even beyond the last talk we heard. You know, what happens with the dentate gyrus over a lifetime, essentially? So I have up here two possibilities that have, you know, these are kind of extreme examples. But this is what some people in thinking of this neurogenesis problem have kind of thrown out there, and that is that if you don't have new neurons, the hippocampus will tend to, you know, one of two things may happen. One is that new information may come in and interfere with the old information. This idea would basically say that as time passes, your dentate and subsequently all the downstream areas will become very adept at encoding this first information. But once you learn new information later on in time, you saturate the capacity, the whole system will shift to encode the new stuff and is unable to encode the old stuff. And the other alternative is that once the system optimizes itself to encode these early events, there isn't that much plasticity remaining to encode the subsequent events. Now, these are kind of extreme examples, but I throw them in there to kind of illustrate what we and others are beginning to think that might be happening with new neurons, and that is actually that because the population is only gradually coming online, and at these early ages, the immature cells, which are kind of hard to see but green here, are the most plastic in the network, you actually can get multiple representations of different times encoded in the same network without any cross interference across the events that happen months apart. So in my model, we did a similar study. I told you how I grew it up. What I didn't mention was I was actually changing the environments over time that the system was exposed to. And at the end of this test period, I actually went back and exposed the network to each of the familiar environments. And you see large populations of cells had specialized to each specific population, whereas the novel event, so day 160, this novel event doesn't have specialized encoding. It still gets encoded by the dentate, but since it's never been experienced, there are no neurons there that are highly tuned to that. After being exposed to this environment for a while, the young cells at this point begin to specialize to that environment. So back in the schema here, you end up, the idea is that the dentate itself, this structure in the brain, is continuously updating itself to become more specialized to whatever events are being encountered over months and years. So this kind of gives us an idea of how neurogenesis can be affecting timescales from whatever pattern separation is occurring at, and probably within seconds and less than a second, as well as temporal separation and this kind of long-term specialization role, which kind of lets us fill in some of these gaps, that aren't generally studied by much in neuroscience. So then the question that I've been actually asking, you know, the stuff I presented up to now was stuff that we published last year, but the questions I've been kind of shifting towards lately have been whether neurogenesis can affect the some of these shorter dynamics that generally are, you know, thought to be much faster than the process of a maturing neuron. So the results I'm going to talk about, at this, you know, to finish up here real quick, are very preliminary and kind of is shift in my approach. But I want to go back to this kind of, this role of this GABA function. So the young cells, as I mentioned earlier, tend to not be as inhibited by GABA and actually can be depolarized by GABA at some phase, at early ages. And at the same time, they're developing their ability to spike in the network. And this is kind of a mystery as to when these cells actually become functionally integrated. Now, you can say that they receive inputs at 2 weeks or so of age, but when can they fire an action potential that's communicated downstream? And we still don't know the answer to that. So just, you know, these next results, keep in mind that we don't know whether the young cells actually have an impact on the network or not. So recently I've been reconfiguring my model to actually be able to look at really short timescales and have a millisecond level resolution. And kind of without neurogenesis, what you see, and this is just a kind of a dirty example of that, is if I just kind of get a correlate of a local field potential and that is kind of measure all the voltages of the compartments in an area, you can see kind of some oscillations that are going around theta frequencies. And the granule cell spikes tend to be line up, you know, along, these would be sinks in a local field potential. They tend to kind of go in phase with theta. But when you add new neurons, immature cells that kind of have these heterogeneous properties, so some of, you know, not all of them are the rigid sparse coating mature neurons, you actually see a kind of a scattering of their activity. You lose some of the synchrony in the network, and the field potential gets a little messier. And when you probe down into it, they're not in line as much with the rhythmicity of the underlying rhythmicity of the network when they spike. So this very messy graph, and it's not a very high end. But what I actually see, and this is kind of indicating where we're going to go next, is that the young cells that are firing, that are, you know, maybe 10 to 20 days old, they're not just firing out of phase with theta. They're just firing, you know, on their own. They don't really respect the underlying rhythmicity the same way that the mature neurons seem to appear to do. And so this suggests that that the young cells that are coming into the network may have very distinct responses in regard to the underlying oscillations. And this may have some interesting computational impact, as well as, you know, the talk we're about to hear, how you actually can listen to electrophysiologically these immature neurons, because up to this point, there's no way to really say this cell that's firing is an immature neuron. Well, if there is a relationship of the cell's activity to the underlying rhythmicity, you might be able to at least make some educated guesses. So, you know, back to my Terry-inspired graph, it looks like from the research that I've been doing along with Janet and Rusty, it looks like these immature neurons definitely can have an ability to affect cognition and memory formation at these long timescales over, you know, from, you know, 10 to the 1 to 10 to the whatever, and going even all the way down to very short timescales, the distinct properties of these immature neurons and the heterogeneity that they introduce to the hippocampus can affect some of these much faster dynamics that we haven't previously thought about too much with regard to neurogenesis. So just to acknowledge, this work was done in Rusty Gage's lab, and along with Janet, who's a active member of TDLC, even though she's about, 12,000 miles away, however far away Australia is. And we do a lot of our work in collaboration with the Chiba Lab and with Andrea, Lara, and Lolly Quinn. And thank you very much.
So I have just a clarification. When you say heterogeneous? Is that anything different? Is that different? Do you mean anything different from heterogeneous?
It's Texan.
You have a technical meaning that I'm not aware of.
No, it's
heterogeneous.
Texan shrinking of the words.
Oh, no, that's good. No, I just was a little was wondering. So here's the question. You have these new neurons being born, but don't you have to have some neurons dying? Because otherwise they would fill up the whole brain.
Well,
I mean, there has to be turnover.
I have a part of my slide that talked about cell death, but it was very short. Actually, it's not that interesting, but the cell death actually, most of the cells die early on in their development. I'd say up to 50%, depending on what's going on, will die between 1.5 and 3 weeks or so. Those that do survive, there appears to be a very strong environmental signal that says this cell, something about the behavior of the animal is important for this cell's survival, so keep it around. Now, these are in standard laboratory housed animals, so you know you do see robust cell death in those cases. We don't know how natural conditions, how much cell death there is, really. And the other issue is there's really no way to trace how much cell death you have of mature neurons. The problem with histology is you can label a cell if it's there. It's hard to label a cell if it died a month ago. So we really don't know the answer how many mature cells die off, but it does appear that cell death is a key factor in the actual neurogenesis process. But it's a very interesting one in regard to, correlation, the relationship of neurogenesis and behavior.
I'm fascinated by all of this, of course. And I guess in the results that you were showing about the there being less separation, things that occurred within the similar temporal window, and more separation if they occurred further apart in time, it sort of reminds me of behavioral studies on, consolidation of motor learning and so on. I'm not sure motor learning goes on in the dentate, but it provides a mechanism for, protecting the memory that's now been stored from being interfered with by other memories coming in, after that window has closed. And so I think it would be interesting to see these ideas applied to sort of more of the behavioral data of that kind, and I wonder if you've thought about that.
Well, we've definitely been trying to think of ways of testing for a behavioral signal that would kind of, as a theorist, I can make theories all day long, but someone's going to want to test them. And so actually having a behavior that can show, there is a strong, this temporal coding, that's what you want to call it, can, help consolidation or do something. You knock out neurogenesis and it doesn't happen. I haven't thought about it with regard to some of those, the motor consolidation of motor learning and so forth. We generally
would also apply other kinds of learning.
I think just now consolidation has come on the map in, with relation to neurogenesis. And it's, very early days in that. I think generally we've thought of it as an encoding, because most people think of the dentate gyrus as an encoding region. But what is actually, how it relates to the consolidation, which is, very likely actually, we're just beginning to think about. More questions? Hand over to Andrea.
No, you can keep talking. That's fine.